You know, you might see a lot of stuff, good stuff, but to be honest with you, the foundation is from all the bad shit I've been through. And, you know, I never ever want to go back to that place ever again. So for me, the way I do that is to stay disciplined. I have my faith. I push myself like I'm preparing for a game. I've got to have that purpose to, you know, I'm 43 years old and I feel like, you know, rugby league saved my life. I was a persistent youth offender as a young man. Yep. I'm not talking about it too much because I want to buy the book.
If you've ever wondered how someone turns a tough upbringing, brushes with trouble and life setbacks into a story of resilience, performance and reinvention, today's guest is a masterclass in doing just that. Meet Keith Mason, former professional rugby league player, Challenge Cup winner, actor, author, entrepreneur and philanthropist. Keith's journey from playing for clubs like St. Helens and Huddersfield, earning England and Wales caps and surviving the pressure cooker of elite sport to walking into movie sets and building meaningful relationships with the likes of Mickey Rourke and Joe Calzaghe is nothing short of remarkable. In this episode, Keith shares what it really takes to perform at the highest level, how rugby league saved his life and the lessons learned from both the glory and the dark days, like navigating court battles, career setbacks, and life after sport. He opens up about guiding his son's rise in the English Super League, finding pride in performance, and turning challenges into opportunities for growth. So if you're a growth-driven man who loves your sport, this episode will give you a front row seat into a life forged by grit, resilience, and a relentless pursuit of excellence, full of lessons you can take into your own game on and off the field. I'm Ian Hawkins, and this is Sport is Life. The purpose of sport as I see it is to see your vision become a reality, find your voice, create strong connections, and learn to trust your body. Okay, Keith, how you going?
I'm all right, mate. Good morning, all the way from the UK. It's a bit dark outside, so I've got all the lights on. And my partner's come downstairs. She's like, it's like Blackpool Illuminations downstairs. I'm talking to you, Sozzy bloke. Got an interview. Yeah.
So, I didn't think about it at the time, but it's great timing with the first Ashes in 20 odd years coming up in the next week.
Yes, 20 odd years, man. It don't seem like that long ago, to be honest with you, but I mean, as you get older, as you know, time keeps getting faster and faster, and the years are passing by. But I'm looking forward to it actually. But I will be in Qatar for the first test, so I'm going away with my family next week. Night break to Doha, first time to Doha. So, but I will be tuning in. I'll be looking in to see how the English boys go. So. I think it will be a very. I don't think a lot of people are saying, you know, Australia are going to, you know, smash the English boys, but I think the English boys will be up for it. There's a lot of pride in that shirt, so it'll be an interesting watch. But I mean, like I said, Australia have got a fantastic team, and you know, some fantastic halfbacks in Munster and Cleary, and then you've got some solid backs and some really big forwards. So it's going to be an interesting watch.
I hope it's close. I've got to be honest, I don't know a heap about the English team. I feel like when we were growing up, we knew so many of those players. Maybe it's because some of them came out and played in the NRL back in the day. But, yeah, it'll be good to see some of these guys go around. And, again, hopefully it's a nice close affair over the three tests.
Yeah.
I was just saying before we hit record, you've packed a heap of things in, and I know you said you feel like you've got heaps more to go, but the thing that really stood out when I was just having a flick through all of your platforms before was like your young fella is playing for Wigan boys team. That must be a proud dad moment.
Yeah, obviously, you know, Lucas, he kind of followed me throughout my career. He was my biggest fan. So at the club I played at, he was like, he supported that club and he supported his dad, and it was nice to, take my son to a couple of finals, and he wanted to do it. He wanted to. I never pushed him into the rugby. His mum took him to the rugby. He was born in St. Helens, so when I came back from Melbourne, time for Saints. I met his mum in St. Helens, and then obviously Lucas came about in 2005. And I think he was around about 5 years old. We took him to his first team, which was Clockface Miners, which was in St. Helens. And the funny thing is, like, Lucas used to actually train with me. So when he was like 3 or 4 years old, I'd take him to the Giants. I played at the Giants, and he'd come in and he'd be running around, he'd running the boys ragged, and so he had it in him to succeed, because he was exposed to that rugby league environment, and plus he's a talented kid, but he's part of the first team at Wigan, not the boys, by the way.
Oh wow, how good. That's amazing.
So basically this year, obviously Wigan are a very, very strong team. Lucas is only 19. It's come through the development of the scholarship, the academy, into the first team, and then he's gone on dual registration with the Broncos. So obviously the
Okay.
London Broncos, Darren Lockyer has took over there. So he played around about 18 games, which is fantastic for his experience. And he played really well. As a 19-year-old, he stuck to these some of these ex-Super League international players, and I think he's had an outstanding season. So I'm really looking forward to where he's going to be at next year after another pre-season under his belt.
Yeah, amazing. Does it, like, I know it's quite tribal over there as well in the rugby. Is it weird seeing him in Wigan colours, given you played for St. Helens?
Yeah, well, it's funny because I was at the grand final on the weekend. I was in the Stretford stand, which was all the Wigan Warriors fans, and a lot of the Wigan Warriors fans were giving me the eye, thinking, that's Keith May, because I was kind of like a bit of a pantomime villain back in the day when I used to play against Wigan. But the rivalry between St. Helens and Wigan, there's no rivalry like it. I mean, Hull and Hull KR and Hull FC are big, but I remember making my first team debut, not first team, St. Helens debut on the Good Friday. I'd just flown over from Melbourne, and there must have been 20,000 fans packed in at the old St. Helens Stadium, Knowsley Road, and the atmosphere was unbelievable. And that was my first experience, first test in a Good Friday game, a derby game, and the intensity was probably like a test match. It was, yeah, they hated each other.
Wow. I think that's the thing we watch as NRL fans, envious of the atmosphere of those games and the singing and yeah, it'll be something pretty special. I think this Ashes tour coming up and hopefully well, I don't know. I think two of them are already sold out, are they?
I don't think Wembley will be sold out.
No.
That's 90 plus thousand people. But I think there's Everton probably will be, and the other. I'm not sure what the other test match is. I'm guessing it will be in.
Is it Ellen Road? Did I read?
I'm guessing it. One will be in Lancashire. One will be in Yorkshire. So Elland Road is a great stadium as well. So yeah, like I said, I've been to a football game. I went to watch a Liverpool game a long, long time ago, and the atmosphere was very quiet. It was like non-existent, right? There was nothing going on. Now, you can go to an English Super League game. For instance, you can go down to Wakefield and they've got 7,000 fans there. It sounds like there's 47,000 fans. It just depends how intense the game is. But the British fans are very, very vocal and passionate, I tell you that.
Yeah, of course I'm biased. I grew up playing football, but I'm a rugby fan. I just don't think, like, Rugby league's got so much more happening, like every minute, than a football game has. And after just, I think it was the, I think it might have been the prelim final or the qualifying final where the Broncos made one of their comebacks. And I was like, I just, football can't do that stuff like that. Again, biased as a fan, but I'm with you on that.
Yeah, so it's the best spot. It's the best spot in the world. It's a shame it doesn't get as much, let's say, publicity as it should do in the UK or all over the world, to be honest with you. But to be fair, rugby league in England, it's the M62 corridor, so you've got all the way from Liverpool all the way to Hull, and really that's who you're picking for your England team. You've got the teams in Lancashire, teams in Yorkshire, M62 corridor. You've got the nucleus of the best players down that corridor. So really, we're at a disadvantage straight away because we've only got that pool of players to really pick from. On a whole, obviously you'll have some players that are not from Lancashire and Yorkshire, but most of the nucleus of the English team are from Lancashire and Yorkshire, and that's it.
Which, and again, it just shows that how much you probably punched above your weight from that perspective, because in Australia, they have a much bigger pool to choose from.
Yeah, of course. And me playing out there, it being probably the number one sport in Australia, it's not just about the pool of players, but it's also about the lifestyle. What I noticed when I got there, everybody's out running it. People are wanting to exercise and fit, and then people are happy. But you come to England now, there's no sun for 6 months. So, you've got these dark mornings, you've got no beach around here. If you've got a beach, you go to Blackpool, and it's a pebble beach. So it's a different lifestyle, different culture. But like I said, the English boys, we all pretty much, a lot of lads grow up through on council estates, rough areas, and they get, kind of. We don't go to private schools anyway, rugby league players. As in, rugby union boys, they go to, what's it, private school? There's nothing wrong with private school, by the way. But generally, the lads who play rugby league come from very working class families. Tough bringing up.
Yeah, similar here, and I think there's probably a bit more of a harder edge to them for that reason, right? They know what tough is because they've been born into it in a lot of ways.
Yeah, different places.
What inspired you to come to Melbourne? I feel like I've all a lot of the league players I've had on have been all Storm players, or seems to be most of them. So I didn't even know you'd like.
Yeah.
It's really testing my memory. Yeah, so what inspired you to come out here and try your luck?
Well, to be fair, I mean, every English rugby league player dream, I don't care what you say, would to come down to Australia and test themselves, or come down and just experience playing in the NRL, but also going down there and living down there. And seeing the life, Australia is a place that a lot of people would love to travel. It's just not, it's 12,000 miles away. It's just not around the corner. So how the Melbourne Storm came about is, I was playing first team football at Wakefield. I was 18, just turned 19, so I was pretty young. I was playing front row. Again, I was playing week in, week out for Wakefield as a front rower. I know, playing some good football. That year, I got the Young Rising Star. There was a lot of talk about me coming through the ranks as a young star coming through the game as a front rower. And so I got a phone call. I was at training. I got a phone call by a guy called Neil Kelly. Now, Neil Kelly was the Wales first team coach, and they were playing England. I believe it was the day after he called. It was a test match at Wrexham, and he just asked. I think it was John Arbin at the time was the coach, Tony Kemp, he came up to me and says, "Oh, Keith, you know what? Neil Kelly's asked you if you'll be available to play for Wales." And I said, "Wales? Oh, I'm not Welsh, I'm English." So, so he said, "Well, apparently you've got somebody Welsh in your family. I think it might be your granddad or your grandma." So I kind of had to, they had to look up that. I had to make a few phone calls. Do I qualify? But also, if I were going to play for Wales, then I wanted to make sure that that wouldn't jeopardise my future playing for England.
Yep.
So I decided I was going to play, and I thought, well, this is going to be a fantastic opportunity to play for Wales against England in a test match at Wrexham. Now, my preparation wasn't great. I drove down to Wrexham from Wakefield, which is probably about maybe an hour and a half away, 2 hours away. I got there, went to the stadium. The boys did a bit of a run through. Literally trained for half an hour. I was selected in that game to play front row, and I went out there and played, and we actually nearly beat England.
Wow.
So if you think about it, that Wales team I played in, we only had like three or four Super League players. The rest of the players was division was Championship players. So Kieran Cunningham played, right? He was the loose forward. We had Lee Breers. Martin Pearson, who was at the time, he was at Wakefield. He was our centre or fullback, and myself and a guy called Chris Tassel. So, five players, Super League players, and the rest was Championship players. They had, and I'll just go through their team now. They had Brad Linsky,
Yeah.
Paul Wellens, they had Leon Price, Paul Scunthorpe, Andy Farrell, the late Terry Newton, Barry McDermott, Terry O'Connor, Paul Anderson. I just reel them all off.
Decent
So,
side, and I do know those names, so that's how like that's how strong a side it was back then.
yeah, so this was back in 2001. I think it was 2000. Yeah, 2001, because I went to Melbourne in 2002. So, we was winning 26-10 at half time in that game.
What?
Yeah. 26-10. Don't ask me how, but it was honestly, I went out, we sang the national anthem, which was amazing because everybody in the stadium was singing, you know, the Taffy song, the Welsh song. I didn't have no clue what the words were, but I was involved. So just going back, just before the start of the game, Greg McCallum came in. Greg McCallum used to, you know, he was a referee, you
Ref,
know,
yeah.
Super League. Yep. He gave me a letter just stating that it wouldn't jeopardise my future as an England player. So I was happy with that. And from that game, and I had a standout game. It was a televised game. The Melbourne scouts had been watching, looking for an English player, an English forward. To pick up, and luckily I got spotted in that game, and it eventually led to Chris Johns flying out. I got picked for Great Britain 21s to go to South Africa at end of that season. Chris Johns came over, and at the same time, Gary Everington, who was chief executive at Leeds Rhinos, offered me a very lucrative deal, a 4-year deal to go to Leeds. Now I had the opportunity to pick Melbourne, Leeds, and ironically, just a couple of years before that, I was trialling at Leeds. I was a 17-year-old kid, and I remember Dean Bell coming up to me and telling me that I'd never be a Super League player. This is
Wow.
a great Dean Bell, actually. So I left Leeds and went to sit Wakefield. They gave me my first opportunity. Within 2 years being at Wakefield, I was in the NRL. So it just goes to show our time, you know, if you persevere and don't give up, you know, great things can happen for you, and that's what I did. I persevered, and you know, I had the opportunity to go to Leeds. I turned Leeds down, which felt quite good.
Yeah.
I went to Melbourne, and I had two of probably the best adult years of my life, young adult years of my life. It was amazing.
Yeah. Was Bellamy hadn't started coaching then. Who was it, Chris Anderson?
No, so when I got there, Muppet was the coach then, Mark Murray.
Yep.
So I went there. I remember doing my first pre-season. Now I was a fit lad, and geez, because it was so warm. It's so warm in the winter. I'm like, oh well, next year summer actually. So, and I really struggled, but in England I was like the fittest at Wakefield by a mile. I always prided myself on being super fit, and I was kind of like near the back of the group, and that really caught me off guard. So it took me about 12 months to acclimatize. The pre-season, the next pre-season, I was up there with Billy Slater and all these guys. So it was Matt Murray, and Craig Bellamy came in 2003. And continued from there. But when Bellyache came in, obviously he came in with a no nonsense attitude. Train hard, and that was probably the hardest pre-season I've ever done. Which to be the best, you need to train hard. You need to be in top shape.
You wouldn't be the first person that said that about a Melbourne pre-season. I think it's quite infamous, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I remember Bellyache, he used to hide behind trees and stuff. We used to go, we do like heavy leg session in the morning. Then we'd go outside, we put the bodysuits on, just the forwards, and we'd bash the hell out of each other for the next 45 minutes. Then from that, we'd have his dinner, and then we'd go up to a place called Studley Park. Now think about it being 38 degrees, we're talking 90 degrees weather in the afternoon, and we do like these 2K runs, but we do them four times. So we do a 2K run as fast as possible, up and down through all these woods. It was ridiculous. We had five groups: the fittest group, the unfittest group, and then you were taking over these guys who have gone in front of us. I remember a guy called Antonio Cafusi. Remember Antonio Cafusi? Played for Australia. Played for Melbourne. Now Antonio was a big boy back then, right? So he'd just come down from Brisbane, and I remember running past him, and he was laid on his back, and his feet were up on a branch, right? And he was having a breather, okay? And I just remember bellyache in the background screaming, "Hey, fucking get up, mate! Get up!" Like so. I'm doing these runs, and that luckily, that pre-season I was fit. I pushed myself really, really hard, and I was proud because I was the only Englishman there. And the boys made me feel so welcome. People like Robbie Kearns, we had Stephen Kearney there, Robbie Ross, Scott Hill, Matt Orford, Marcus Bye, Richard Swain. And then the young boys coming through, we were all the same age. Cameron Smith, who I lived with when I first went there, with Jake Webster. And you've got Cooper, Kronk, Billy Slater, and Mitchell Sargent, Mick Russell. You had all these young players coming through, and Ryan Hoffman, and all this. And it was a fantastic. Fantastic experience for me, and I talk about it in my new book, Against All Odds, which is my autobiography, which is coming out. I'm not sure if it's done, the book's done, but if it comes out this year, I will let you know. And so, but I speak about the chapter's called Purple Pride, and I talk about how I went over to Melbourne as a boy and came back a man. So. But I talk about the ups and downs because it wasn't always great. I remember making my debut and scoring on my debut against West Tigers in the pre-season, and then the week after we went down to play for Brisbane North, right, theatre club. There was quite a lot of us down there, Cameron, Billy, and all that, and I did my knee. It was real injury. I did my medial ligament, my shoulder were nearly touching my back of my ankle. It was a bad one. So I was out for 6 to 8 weeks, so that was a really tough time for me because
Yeah, I bet.
never lived on my own, never been away from, I live with my mum, and now I'm pretty much on my own, having to fend for myself, and then being injured was a big blow for me. So it was quite a depressing start to my career in Melbourne.
Yeah, I bet. Because the players talk about it now still. What you sort of you're disconnected from the main group because you're stuck in rehab. You're not doing training, and then you're talking about being on the other side of the world without your family support. That must have been a nightmare. I'll come back to the book, but you mentioned fantastic experience. Another fantastic experience. I want to hear about the Challenge Cup final win. Must have been all time.
Yeah, so wow. When I was a kid, I used to watch Wigan, Leeds, Hull, Widnes, all these great teams. You remember like Kurt Sorensen and Ellery Hanley, all fantastic teams playing at Wembley. So every young rugby player's dream was to play in a Challenge Cup. Right, to win a Challenge Cup, and I still believe it's the best competition in the world to win. I remember talking to Chris Joynt. Chris Joynt was it was my captain at St. Helens the first season I was there, and Paul Scunthorpe was the captain in 2004 when we won the Challenge Cup. Joynt were telling me that the Challenge Cup is the best one to win, and to be honest with you, playing in that final was probably the best rugby league day of my life. Week actually, because it's the build to the. So, I can't explain how awesome that day was. Especially playing against Wigan as well, right? And they had some brilliant players. I mean, they were brilliant. Two world-class teams, and it was a proper final. It was a red-hot day. Bank holiday back in 2004. We were driving down the streets, and the streets were just red and white. It was just chock-a-block. I think it was a sellout that day. I think there was 74,000 people.
So was that the old Wembley, or are we in Cardiff at that point? Were they rebuilding, or where would it have been? Oh.
There was rebuilding the Wembley, but this was at Cardiff. Yeah, so Cardiff is like. It's like a coliseum. It's right on top of you. We took the roof off that day, and it was just amazing. Just everything were amazing. Like the build up, the form we were going into the final. Some of the players, I mean, our team was Paul Wellens at fullback. You had Eddie Gardner, Darren Albert, who was a grand final winner. Fantastic player. You had Willie Talau in the centres.
Yeah, played for the Bulldogs.
I think Jamie Lyon came the year after. I mean, he was one of the best players I've ever played with. Then in the halfbacks, you had Jason Hooper, who was fantastic. He had a really good season that year from the Dragons. Sean Long. The forward pack was myself, Nick Fozard, Kieran Cunningham. Lee Gilmore, Chris Joynt, Paul Scunthorpe. So we had a great team, and they and their pack, reversing onto their pack, they had Pongia, the late Quinton Pongia, amazing player, Craig Smith, Terry Newton, the late Terry Newton, God bless him. They had some young players in there, Gazzoch, Danny Tickle, Andy Farrell. I think Adrian Lamb. Was it Adrian Lamb played in that game? Might have been him or Danny Orr, but they had Radlinskis and all that. But yeah, the atmosphere that day was unbelievable. And to win it in front of my family was probably the best feeling ever. So yeah, and I was lucky to be part of three Challenge Cup finals, but obviously I lost them two. But the first one I played in, I won, and honestly, I really felt like, when I picked the trophy up, I felt like, looking back on my life, it all just flashed before me. I'd actually achieved something. I've made history, and it was an amazing feeling, and to do it with you, to do it with your teammates, on that day in a full house, and yeah, it's unexplainable, but it was a fantastic day, and it's something that I'll never forget. And you know what? I feel bad for people who never get to the final, never experience that. Because don't get me wrong, there's some amazing players that have never gone on to win stuff. Nathan Einmarsh. I mean, I know he's won like test series and stuff. But I'm guessing to win a grand final would be the same type of feeling. So.
Yeah, he still cops plenty of grief about that, don't worry.
Yeah, he was one of my favourite players back in the day. Was I just loved his work rate and that. He was a tremendous competitor.
Can you remember the actual day? Like you're talking about how good it was. Like were there some moments like did they do the English national anthem, the British national anthem? Do you remember sort of key moments in the game? Any moments of where you contributed something important?
Yeah, so. It's funny because I had actually I was interchanged three times, which is quite rare for a front row because I did the first 15 minutes, came off, then I came back on with 10 minutes to go, and I was involved in a series of seven to eight passes, and I put short Paul Wellens under the post, Andy Farrell came flying out the line, I put
How good.
Paul the post, and this was just before half time, so that was a bit of a killer blow because I think we was one try up. I put Wellens under the post, and we was I think 12 points up, which gave us a nice buffer going into the second half. And then I did 20 minutes of the second half, came off for 10 minutes, and came back on again for the last 10 minutes. So I think Millwall knew how to use me. Now looking back, I wasn't the biggest of front rowers. Like I'm 6'1", right? I played around about 100 and, at my heaviest, I was 104 or 105. But when I was fit, I was around about 102. But I played with intensity. Everything I did was 100 mile an hour. I wasn't saving myself, and one thing I do miss about, which I did struggle with when I retired, was the physicality of the game. Now, I'd say I was a very physical player, right? I like to go up against the bigger the better. So if it was Adrian Marley or Jamie Peacock or whoever I'm playing against, the bigger the player, the more I enjoy it because it's more of a test. And I said to my son, when you go out there, you want to test yourself. And when you're playing, even if you're losing, you've got to have pride in your performance. You've got to keep performing to for the full 80 minutes. And that's what I always try to do is to perform. To have some pride in my performance. Because at the end of the day, there's 13 players going out there. It only takes one or two players to have a bad day, and that could, result in a loss. But for me, starting so young as a front row forward, playing nearly 300 games, I was thrown to the wolves, and I played in an era when it was tough.
Tough.
You had Big Bad Barry. McDermott.
Kieran Cunningham's the one that sticks in my head when those test matches.
Yeah, well, Kieran's probably the best player I played with. He's a true leader, great guy. I remember the first day I rocked up at St. Helens, he goes, "Hey, how you doing, Keith? You all right?" Just fucking hell, we need you, mate. So there was really struggling with St. Helens because Darren Britt was there, and Darren Britt was like he was a very good player for a big man. You look, I mean, he looked like he'd just come off a building site. But I
But
always,
he would have been getting on by that stage though too, wouldn't he?
Oh yeah. I think it was around about 32, but it was 30. He had a good engine.
Yeah.
He had a good
Yeah.
engine. And so I slotted straight in at St Helens. I started the Good Friday game against Saints, against Wigan, sorry. And we was actually beating them 20-0 after 20 minutes. And then they came back, and I believe it was Luke Robinson's debut. He scored an hat trick, and Kevin Brown. And they ended up beating us 22-20. So it's just one of those. It's just, Super League. I mean, it is exciting to watch, but I don't think the game is where it should be right now. I think to be honest with you, I was glad to play in the era that I played in. So, making my debut at 17, played in the early late 90s all the way up to 2013. I retired quite young. I went through a court case, high court case against Huddersfield. I won it for unfair dismissal. At that time, I felt betrayed. Felt betrayed by a club. I played 7 years, went around about 150 games, got to two finals, got the Player of the Year in 2009 when Nathan Brown were there. Nathan Brown was one of my favourite coaches to play under. I thought he was a great guy. He came in and his orders was to, he knew pretty much everybody's strengths, and with me he just said, Keith, I can just play tough, mate, and run hard and tackle hard. And he knew that one of my strengths was my fitness, and I could play big minutes.
Kept it
Yeah.
simple.
Keep it simple, mate. Yeah, I mean, like I said, I always said to my son, you've got to do the things that the crowd don't see, but the coaches see. So, the 1%. So, working out at mark, kick chase, double up, and in defence, kick chase, get off the line hard on the first or second play. Do the things that the naked eye doesn't see. But what makes a great player is them players that do them plays that they don't have to do, but they do them anyway. I think, even chase backs, and Lucas is that type of player where he'll just sponge everything up. He was making average of 47 tackles a game, last year. So down the right side, and that's what you want from your back row. Always, you want your back row always cleaning up,
And as fans, that's what we want to see from our, well, they're the fans' favourite players, right? The wholehearted ones that give it absolutely everything. Just getting to your book, because I know, like, I want to. There's a few other things I want to make sure we cover here, because, like I said, you've thrown a lot into your life so far. I noticed the foreword in your book's written by the great man Joe Calzaghe. Back in my Fox Sports days, we had a fair bit to do with Matchroom and regularly seeing his fights. How did all that come about, the relationship with him, that you got him to write the foreword?
So when I played, we got to a final with Huddersfield Giants. We got to Wembley in 2009. First time we'd been to Wembley. First time Huddersfield Giants had been to a final in a long, long time, probably 40 years, maybe, I think it was. We were playing against Warrington, and Warrington, same again. Warrington have not been in a final for a long, long time, and we actually went into that game favourites. And that was my first defeat in a cup final, which was hard to take because, I remember my son being there up in the stadium with my mum. And we got invited to, this is leading to the Joe Calzaghe friendship. A few other boys got invited to Stringfellas, right? After the game. So we went, we ventured out, went to Stringfellas. This was back in 2009. I remember stood up in this bar, and I was with Scotty Moore. I know the few other boys were in there from Wigan. There was, I think Radlinski was in there. There were a few other Wigan players in there. I don't know why, but they must have been to see the game, and a few of the Huddersfield players. So I remember stood at the bar, and I saw Mickey Rourke walking. So, and Mickey Rourke had just got the BAFTA for The Wrestler. And I'd literally watched that film a couple of weeks before we played in the final, right? I watched it with my cousin. So I said to my friend, I goes, that's Mickey Rourke. And he's like, he goes, who? I goes, Mickey Rourke. He goes, oh, I don't know him. I went, oh, never mind. So I went to this big black guy called Derek. He was his bodyguard. And I said, can I go over and say hello to Mickey? And he says, yeah, go ahead. So I walked over. He was sat down. He was having a drink. I said, hi, Mickey. Nice to meet you. My name's Keith Mason. I really enjoyed your film, The Wrestler. Because with that film, was that like your life story? Because I knew him being a big star in the 80s, and I knew how he just disappeared off the face of the earth, in self-destructive personality. And he says, yeah, pretty much, kid. He goes, what are you, man? Are you a gangster? I goes, no. He goes, are you an athlete? I goes, yeah, I play rugby. I played in a final today at Wembley. He goes, fucking hell. I watched that today. I watched it on my TV, my hotel room on the BBC. And I says, yeah, that was us. Then I cut a long story short, we kind of hit off. He gave me his number, bought me a drink, asked us to follow him. So we followed him from Stringfellas to another bar. We got a taxi. He got us into this private club. Went in there. He was arm wrestling the boys. I remember him whooping Scott Moore. And then, it's mad. And then a big front rower called Daryl Griffin is 6 foot 4, 19 stone. He was my front row teammate. He was wrestling. He was wrestling Scott Moore. Whooped Scott Moore, and then he started wrestling Daryl Griffin. And this is where he tore his bicep off the bone, right? So, and then straight after he did that, he looked at me and I looked at him. And I goes, "Can I arm wrestle you?" He went, "He says, fucking hell, kid, I've just fucking bust my fucking hand, bust my arm." And I'm like, and then he drunk a tequila, so obviously he's not feeling much of what's going on with his arm because he's drunk, right? But then I remember talking to him, and he was talking to me, and we were face to face, and it was nice that he invited me. I'm thinking, wow, this is crazy. This Hollywood megastar is like, inviting me to different, but he's buying me drinks, and it kind of dulled the pain from losing the final, right? So it was, I can forget what we just, we lost at Wembley. And it was a pleasant surprise. So then he was talking to his bodyguard, looking at me, and then he started crying, right? And this was Mickey Rourke. And I could see tears in his eyes, and I said to Derek, I says, what's up with Mickey? And he's like, ah, it's okay, Keith. He just said that you remind him of his brother. And I says to him, I goes, well, why is he crying? Is he all right? And he says, that's the reason why, because you remind him. So, and then I says, well, where's his brother? And he says, and Mickey looked at me and he pointed up and he said, he's in heaven. He passed away. I just thought that was a really, intense moment. Everybody's having a drink, and then it went from that to arm wrestling to, and then
Kind of
in,
tingles.
yeah, so. Then we just became friends from there, me and Mickey. He invited me to the GQ Awards. I remember being at the awards night for the Giants, which Nathan Brown awarded me the Player of the Year, and I got the Man of Steel Award for the club. I had a good year that year, had a really strong season. And I think I was probably unlucky not to get picked for the Great Britain team that season. So, whatever. Whoever they were thinking of, but I think my form was really good that year. I was quite kind of disappointed not to be in the fold. And I remember Mickey's agent ringing me up at the awards and said to me, "Hi, Dean Keith, are you available on Tuesday night? We're going to be going to the GQ Awards, and Mickey wants to invite you. He's up for the Man of the Year." So I went down to the GQ Awards. Spent my evening there with Jason Statham and Mickey Rourke and Bizarre. So So from there, you know, if Mickey flew me out to America, I went out to Beverly Hills, I went out to New York. I'd go and visit Mickey as much as I could. And this is what I was doing when I was playing professional sport. I was flying to Hollywood and going to events where, you know, film stars and that were there, and Tom Jones and all this kind of stuff.
Wow. Yeah.
So anyway, so cut a long story short, I met Mickey, I met Joe through Mickey back in 2010. Mickey's a big fan of Joe, and then Joe, we contacted each other. I was in the peak of my career. He just retired, so he was kind of making that transition. He was trying to get into the acting. He lived in Cardiff, but he had a place in London. He just done Strictly Come Dancing and all that kind of stuff. So it was doing quite a, you know, a few shows and getting out there. But you know, he's a private guy. He doesn't really want to be in the limelight. He's a boxer, right? And that's what he is. I think he tried to get into the films and stuff, but it never kind of worked for Joe. But so I went down to London. I met Joe in the Oxford Circus. We went for a few drinks. I stayed down at Joe's. And we just clicked straight away. As soon as we met each other, we was laughing, we were giggling. We had a lot in common. Obviously, I had a lot of respect for him. I was a fan of him. You know, he's got voted the best British boxer of all time. And we became really good friends. You know, he's Kalani's godfather, my daughter's godfather.
Wow.
We've been good friends ever since. I was friends with his family. I'm really, really close with his dad. You know, Enzo, bless him, he's not here now, but he was a very special man. And yeah, we just clicked. Yeah, we're
Amazing.
friends. Yeah.
Amazing. I know you're limited time, so I want to make sure we get to the acting. Just before we go there, like you clearly keep yourself extremely fit. You look like you could go out and play for England in the Ashes, mate. Like how? Exactly. For those only listening, he's just flexed. Oh my God. So how is it because of the acting, or have you got some other protocol that's kept you motivated to stay as fit and healthy as you are now?
Well, I just think when I retired and that, you know, I went through like I struggled to make that transition. And you hear these stories. I mean, Joe said to me, he goes, "Listen, you're retiring, you're a long time retired. I'm just putting it out there to you to that, you know, it is tough to make that transition." And all I've ever done was play rugby league from 5 to 31. There was a number of reasons why I retired. One of them, I felt betrayed by rugby league, like how Huddersfield had treated me. I went from, you know, earning a lot of money, you know, a six-figure contract, to earning peanuts compared to obviously when I got sacked by the Giants. At the time, I lost my license. I was going through a tough time, wasn't seeing my kids, and then I went to Castleford. Not on a lot of money. Very disenchanted what had happened to me. Going through a high court case, not knowing what's going to happen for that in that court, you know, high court, and not knowing if I'm going to win or not. And thank God I eventually did win. You know, it was a 3-day trial, and I had to get up at court and do my bit. I was on the stand for 5 hours,
Wow.
getting cross-examined. But you know, as a kid growing up, you know, my beginnings wasn't easy. You know, I was kicked out of most of my schools. I had more energy than a normal kid. I wasn't a bad kid. I just went through this naughty phase, a rebellious phase, and the league eventually was a way out for me to channel my aggression, my energy. You know what? I forgot what we were talking about. What we were going on about.
Oh, I was talking about how you motivated yourself to stay fit.
So yeah, I obviously retired. It took me a couple of years to get my head around retirement, and I believe you'll see a lot of. And I'm guessing I've not watched the shows you've been on, but I've seen a few of the boys on there, a few clips. I'm guessing a lot of the boys do say that the transition is really hard.
Yeah, I think it's true for most professional athletes. I've had a few people, ex-athletes, who now help other athletes in that transition. I think it's a pretty common occurrence, unless you've got something that you're going straight into, like the guys who go into media or coaching. Yeah, I'd say you're certainly not alone in that.
Yeah, it was tough. I got, I went away from what made me great, but to be in shape, look after my body. And at that time, I wasn't looking after my body. I was out drinking and partying and doing all loads of bad shit. And it wasn't good for me mentally. I guess in a lot of ways, I was kind of selfish. I wanted to do what I wanted to do, and it kind of burnt all the bridges. I was self-sabotaging. I did feel a lot of guilt and a lot of shame, especially towards my son. Because I just retired, I just thought, that's it, I'm done. Mickey Rourke offered me an opportunity in a film called Skin Traffic, which I took. He gave me a call. He wanted to be in a movie kid, and
Of course.
of course, yes. I was still playing. I was still playing for Castleford at the time, and I think the one thing that got me through that tough time was my discipline in the gym. Now, physical fitness is just as important as mental fitness, mental health, sorry. Physically, to finish, just go for a run, get to the gym, you're going to feel better. So I always tell people, if you feel a bit shitty, you feel a bit down, go fucking work out. Get in the gym, go for a run, go for a walk, get some sunlight. And I'm the type of guy I'm a very routine guy, so I like to go to bed at the same time every night. I like to get up at the same time. I do my cold showers. I believe in Jesus. I pray every day. I ask for protection. I feel like God has got me through a lot of tough times. Probably I'm lucky to be even here speaking to you right now. That's how bad it was when I retired.
Oh, wow.
I
Yeah,
can't.
wow.
I just threw everything away. I don't know what happened, but I was depressed. I was in a bad state. Physical fitness pretty much saved my life, and I've got to be honest with you, it's no joke. I don't drink or anything now. I've not drunk for 10 months now. I've not touched a drop of alcohol. Me and my partner decided we wanted to give up the drinking. But like I said, when I retired, I missed the physical side of the game the most. I'm a very competitive person. I'm very driven. And there's a lot for me to achieve in this life. I'm not done yet. And then I retired, and I thought, wow, I retired. And I was kind of like, I wasn't even past it. I was 31. I could have. And I was a fit guy, and I thought, wow, but I'm not going to go back, and I knew I couldn't go back. I got offered deals to go to Hull and Bradford and all these different Super League teams, and I just said, I don't want any more of it. But I felt bad for my son. I felt shitty. I felt guilt and shame, and these feelings were going through me when I retired. But then I felt alone. I felt like I felt abandoned at time at times, because I just felt, were people my friend because I played sport, or were they my friend because of me, Keith? And I think they were friends because I was a sportsman. And
I know now that's something that you're helping people. Like, was that inspired by the fact that you went through that experience?
yeah, I think there's some stuff I put up on the social media. Sometimes I'll put up, I will put a little bit of wisdom out there. I think there's, I think you've got to walk it and talk it. You cannot not be through a hard period in your life and then talk about how you can get through that period. If you've not fucking been through it, you can't talk about it. You can't say, oh well, da, 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 da. All I can do is come from where I've come from and tell my story. Now, and this is the reason why I don't do many interviews now, because when you read the book, there's going to be a lot of dark shit in there. There's the good, the bad, and the ugly. There's a lot of, you might see a lot of stuff, good stuff, but to be honest with you, the foundation is from all the bad shit I've been through. And, I never ever want to go back to that place ever again. So for me, the way I do that is to stay disciplined. I have my faith. I push myself like I'm preparing for a game. I've got to have that purpose to, I'm 43 years old and I feel like, rugby league saved my life. I was a persistent youth offender as a young man. I'm not talking about it too much because I want to buy the book because it is a very inspiring story. And I actually did a, I don't even know this, but I brought out the first ever rugby league comic book called Rugby Blood.
No, I did not know that.
Yeah, you can. I'll send you the link. You can buy it. It's got real Super League stars in there: Conrad Hurrell, Nathan Cleary. All these players are a part of this book, and it's about a young kid. It's about a young kid who overcomes struggles to become a champion player, and it's kind of like an autobiographical story of my life when I was a kid. I got Super League to endorse it. I came up with the idea. Originally, it was a film script. And
Love it, love it, love
then
it.
I put it to a comic book, so yeah. But yeah, as I said, physical fitness is so important for everybody. You need to be in the gym. You need to discipline yourself. A lot of the issues and problems in life comes from being lazy, not looking after yourself, not being in the gym, not good food, not getting the sunlight, not being around good people. A lot of your problems will be fixed by fixing yourself, not by taking tablets. I've never took a tablet in my life. Even when I was, when I was a complete fuck up, I was in the gym. I stayed in the gym. But I can say now I could probably do 10 minutes of Super League. I'll give you that. Because I see some of these guys running about. There's some of these guys running about, and they're not in great shape. But
You look like you could do a bit more than 10 minutes from my angle.
well,
And I
yeah.
reckon just your whole mindset would probably carry you a few, maybe only once. I don't know if you'd be able to back it up, would you? At 40.
Yeah, well, to be honest with you, I mean, we charity games, with some of the old legends and that, with AJ Marley and stuff like that. And I certainly run around like an headless, like a young kid. But I feel my calves tightening up and I'm nearly pulling my hamstrings and stuff. So, for whatever, five a time and you can't, your body's can't take the knocks as it used to be able to. So, but I do look after myself. Fitness is a massive part of my life.
Yeah, and it's quite evident. I love that the whole part there, the last 5, 10 minutes. If anyone's going to take anything from this story, it's the inspiration you gave through all of that, Keith. That's so good. I want to make sure we touch on your acting. So you've got a bit of a leg up there from your mate Mickey, but you've obviously had to really throw yourself into this skill to be able to get the roles you're getting now. You've got a lead part now, is that right?
So I've currently got a film out in America. It's called Imperative, also known as The Punished. I play an alcoholic detective. We filmed this film in Yorkshire, in Halifax, Wakefield, around the West Yorkshire area. I shot the film with a guy called Thierry Chavimuto, a young director. We came up with a story a number of years ago, and obviously I was wanting to get into the acting, but I'm not in London, I'm not in America. It's like, but for me, with my mindset is like when I want to achieve something, nothing's going to stop me, and I'll keep going till I get there, any way out, any way possible. So we did the film, we shot the film around Yorkshire. We did it on a very low budget. I got a producer involved. I got a young score guy who scored the film, and it was an original score. My character was a guy who's got a very dark past. You know, he's got a big, massive dark cloud over his head. He struggles with mental health. He struggles with drugs. And this case comes up, and it brings him alive. He's rekindled by this serial killer, and it's kind of like a cat and mouse chase. So this guy knows that my character, Jack Sullivan, he drinks on the job. You know, he takes drugs, he drinks, he tries to escape life. You know, he's fucked up basically. And when you're watching it with the audience, you're trying to figure out why he's the way he is. And then halfway through the film, you understand why he's the way he is. He doesn't trust anybody. He has a hard shell around him. So we had the premiere. We had the premiere at the Everyman Cinema. Leeds went really well. It was a red carpet event, and it was kind of like, well, I've gone from the rugby, now I'm walking down the red carpet. It was kind of, you know, I found something else. What was a passion, and you know, I was looking for something to fill that void. At one point it was alcohol and everything else, and now I was throwing myself into something positive, something that made me feel alive, and something that I felt like I could do. And thanks to Mickey Rourke for, you know, giving me the olive branch. He gave me the opportunity. I did the film Skin Traffic. I had 13 lines in the film, and I remember Mickey getting a brown bag. In fact, Joe Calzaghe came down to the hotel that day in Knightsbridge while we were filming, and Mickey got a brown bag, and in that bag was around about £300,000. And I
Wow.
was like, wow. I goes, what is that for a bit of work, Mickey? He goes, yeah, kid. I went, wonder if I work hard as I work hard as an actor at rugby, I might get a brown paper bag like that one day. So that was my thinking, and I've never given it up. You know, I've persevered. I've done a lot of stuff. I've done Peaky Blinders. I've done a lot of TV work. I've got a film in pre-production called The Chosen, where I'll play an Irish detective. There's a lot of stuff in the pipeline for me. I have an American agent and an English agent, so it is a tough industry to be in. But I think, also talking about physicality, I think for me to be in shape and look after myself is important as well. But for getting roles, if that makes sense.
Yeah, fantastic. My head was going, you're describing those sort of films. I'm thinking, oh, maybe I need to see you in a Guy Ritchie film soon. He sounds like you'd be a perfect part for one of his characters.
Yeah, I guess it will be nice. Like I said, I'm ready for whatever's to come. But when it comes to, like, you know, rugby league was, it saved my life. You know, I had a successful career. You know, I won a league leaders. I won a Challenge Cup. I've been a part of another two more Challenge Cups. I've played in some of the greatest teams in the world. You know, I play with some of the greatest players. I'm still friends of all the Melbourne boys over there. We all are in a group chat. I'm very grateful for rugby league. It did save my life, and I've met some wonderful, wonderful people throughout the game. And now, you know, I've got my son playing at Wigan, who's got a big future. You got to look out for him, Lucas Mason. He's a back rower. He's tough. He's got skill. He's got a great future. And you know, his agent's Isaac Moses. I don't know if you know who that is, but he's an Aussie. And
Yes.
I think, you know, Isaac wanted to pick Lucas up because, you know, I think he sees his pathway as going down to in Australia in a couple of years. So you might actually see another Meso back down under
That
before you
would be
know.
fantastic. Yeah, well, let's make sure if that happens that I get a chance to meet him face to face. That'd be fantastic. And of course, his old man would have to come out and watch him.
Oh yeah, definitely. Like I said, you know, we've my son now coming into rugby. When I retired, you know, a lot of rugby players will just want to have a cold turkey. I didn't want to know rugby. I didn't even watch a rugby game for 2 years when I retired. But I've been rekindled now by my son playing, and I can talk to Lucas, and you know, I'm kind of like a mentor to him, but I will give him advice about certain stuff, what he's doing on the field, maybe what he needs to do more of. But ultimately, I'm his dad. You know, I love him. I love him. He's my son. The rugby thing is what he loves to do, and that's great. But I won't love him any less or any more if he didn't play rugby. But I'm going to be there to support him, and I think he's got a very big future. And I think you'll be seeing a lot of Lucas in the future, in the near future.
Well, I look forward to it. Keith, as you said earlier, you don't do many interviews. I'm so grateful and appreciative that you were willing to come on and share your story. This was an absolute cracker. Lots of great stories and inspiration, and I'm really looking forward to what's next. I'll have to make sure I get a copy of the book, and we'll make sure once that is available, we'll get the link in the show notes too, so people can check it out. Yeah, thanks again for coming on.
No, you're welcome. You're welcome, Ian, mate. It's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure talking about the good old days. And well, you know, I think the future's well is looking good for me and my family. And as long as my family's all right, as long as you know my mom and stuff and people I care about in a good place, then I'm happy. Anything else, you know, with rugby league is a bonus for me. I want to thank God for being there for me through the toughest of times, and I think if you're in a hard time, if you're going through a tough time, just remember, like, you know, your struggles develop your strengths and the storms make you stronger. So hang in there.
Well said. Thanks, mate. The big takeaways from today's conversation with Keith Mason: life can be turned around no matter how tough your start. Resilience and grit make all the difference. Pride in performance isn't just about winning, it's about giving your best every single time. Setbacks, dark days, and transitions are part of the journey. How you respond shapes your future. Mentorship, guidance, and leading by example can have a massive impact, whether on the field or at home. And connecting your passions with purpose creates a life of impact and fulfillment beyond sport. Whether you're a parent, coach, athlete, or leader, these are the kind of lessons that can shape your personal life game plan and help you show up at your best in every arena. If this episode resonated with you, share it with someone who could benefit from Keith's story and insights. You've taken the time to listen to this whole episode. Now it's time to take action. Commit to one thing you've learned today and make it happen. And to avoid any obstructions, join the Sport is Life movement by clicking on the link in the show notes.